Okay, welcome to part two of Working with Sexuality as Healthcare Practitioners. Again, this is Lauren Brehm, and I'm so excited to welcome you to this course. So today, we're going to be talking about culture, and I start with culture because it's so important. I compare it to a fish in water. The fish is only as healthy as the water it swims in, and we can tell a lot about that fish by the water. And today we're going to look at the water that we all swim in, which is our culture. And I'm going to talk about some current things, and I'm going to talk about some things from the last 100 and 150 years, because these are the things that affected our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents, which we're going to talk a little bit more about in the next class on family. But even if we didn't live through these things, they're so close to us because they impacted the people that raised us and the people that raised them. And what we now know from the study of epigenetics, we know that the experiences of those ancestors not long ago are also affecting us and are carried down through the DNA and have other ways of affecting us even energetically. So it's really important to understand our culture. And when we're working with clients and patients around sexuality, we need to have a broader understanding of what they're experiencing and what might be creating shame for them, what their, you know, history might be with sexuality, so that we can understand them, so that we can hold space for them to heal, and that we can, it's really important to see that, again, sexuality is bigger than just us and our experiences. Our relationship to sexuality is so influenced by how the world around us views sexuality. So let's dive into this examination of culture. So I'm going to control the slides here so you can watch as I talk. Okay, so the first thing we're going to explore with culture is legislation. And legislation is really interesting because it tells us a lot about what the people of that culture and that country feel very strongly about. We see this in the United States, that the different states have the ability to have their own laws, their own legislation, and of course this tells us a lot about what the majority feels in that state. So of course it's never going to apply to everyone, but it shows us the majority. So when looking at legislation, it's really important to begin with an understanding of this word sodomy. And I like to start with this because sodomy is such a misunderstood word. So I'm going to pull up my notes here. So sodomy, most people think that it is sex between two men, that it's anal sex and it takes place between homosexual men. But sodomy is actually any form of sex that doesn't lead to procreation. So this means that it also includes anal sex between a man and a woman, a heterosexual couple. It includes oral sex, both between a different sex couple and a same-sex couple, and it includes sex with animals. So I want you to just take a moment to think about that, because we often, when we hear that word sodomy, we think, oh, that's what those gay men are doing, but it's actually what we're all doing. So sodomy is probably a regular part of your sex life if you're having oral sex, which most of us are, and if you're enjoying any sort of anal pleasure, whether that's just anything from analingus, which is a mouth on the anus, to any sort of small penetration like a finger or a dildo to full penile penetration or a dildo penetration of the anus, you are participating in sodomy. So again, we're all participating in sodomy. And it's important to know that up until 2003, sodomy was illegal in 14 U.S. states. Prior to 1962, sodomy was a felony in every single U.S. state, punishable by a lengthy term of imprisonment and or hard labor, the harshest penalty being in Idaho, where a person convicted could earn a life sentence, and Michigan had a maximum penalty of 15 years and a life sentence for repeat offenders. So again, this could be homosexual men, but this could also be a heterosexual man or woman that was caught in the act of having oral, enjoying oral or anal sex or some sort of sexual act with an animal. Sodomy was illegal in Britain throughout the century until a law not fully repealed until 1967. So again, prior to 1962 in the U.S., sodomy was a felony in every state. It was illegal in Britain until 1967. So up until the 1960s, we had laws that were forbidding us from enjoying oral and anal play with our partners. I find that really, really fascinating. It shows you what the culture, how it felt about those acts. And up until 2003, again, it was still illegal in 14 states. So this, again, not only impacts the rights of homosexual couples, but also was impacting the rights of heterosexual couples. And I just have here, as of April 2014, 17 states either have not yet formally repealed their laws against sexual activity among consenting adults. So there's still 17 states that still have laws against that state what consenting adults can do sexually. So I want you to just take a moment to think about that, that the government is actually controlling what sexual acts we can do with our partners. Now, of course, this is not enforced in a strong way, but it does exist and could be enforced. And there were, during the time of Alfred Kinsey, when he was doing his work in the 50s, there was a big problem with this, where young people were doing jail time for these acts of sodomy, such as oral sex. This was something really damaging to a lot of people, that things that are inherently natural and healthy sexually were being so punished in our society. So I find that really interesting. There's also laws governing every other aspect of human sexuality, if you think about it. So we've got these laws against sodomy, but we also have laws governing the sale of sex or prostitution. We have laws governing marriage. Now, we often just think, again, of the laws that state whether or not homosexual couples can marry, but there have also been laws governing the sexual activity between heterosexual married couples, what they can do. Again, if there's laws against sodomy, that means that a married man and woman cannot perform anal or oral sex with each other in their marriage by law. So that's really interesting. We also have laws governing sexual education. We have abstinence programs, primarily in the United States. And even in other countries in the Western world, it's interesting how much the government controls what is taught in these sexual education programs. They're often very fear-based about HIV. Often they refer to sexually transmitted infections as diseases. So there's a lot of control of how we're educated about sex in the school systems. There are laws governing birth control and abortion, which we're going to talk about a bit at the end of today's class. There are even laws in different U.S. states regarding flirting in public, regarding kissing in public, even the number of dildos that one can own. So it just goes to show you that the government has really been trying to control sexuality. Again, a lot of these things aren't enforced, but they exist. And if they exist in the law books, that means energetically, that's saying something. Okay, so we're moving on to the next slide, which is science and Latin names. So the science of sexuality, this is such an interesting topic because we think of science as being so solid, and yet it is always changing. There's always new information coming out that shows us that what we previously believed to be true was not, and this is very much the case with sexuality. And again, Dr. Alfred Kinsey's research into sexuality was very influential. They actually say that it ushered in the sexual revolution of the 60s because he was the first to really start to document what was true, whereas the 150 years prior to that, there was a lot of misinformation. And prior to that, there was even there are some truths, some made up interesting things. So we're going to talk a little bit about that now, so you can see what the what science has been telling us about sex, because this is, of course, very powerful in our minds. So, gynecologist William Acton stated in his text, The Functions and Disorders of the Reproductive Organs, in 1857, that the majority of women, happily for them, are not very much troubled by sexual feelings of any kind. Yes, physicians believed that women did not experience sexual desire or pleasure. Isn't that wild? So the science of 1857, not that long ago, stated that women were not troubled by sexual feeling of any kind. So they didn't, healthy women did not experience sexual desire or pleasure. And what was believed at the time was that when a woman did express sexual desire, it was seen as a disease that needed to be taken care of immediately. And this woman was treated, and at the time could even include removing her sex organs, like her clitoris or her ovaries or her uterus. So women were not seen as sexual throughout the entire Victorian era. And this is the era that led up to our current time. So prior to this time we live in, we're coming out of this long stretch where women were not seen as having sexuality. Their role was to serve their husbands. Sexual desire was identified just as something that men had, and women of lower classes, like prostitutes. Some people believe that. Some people also believe that prostitutes were just faking the sexual desire. But yes, it was even the sexual desire of men was limited, but at least they were allowed it, whereas women were not. So I'd like to bring your attention to a text from that time. So I'm going to skip ahead a slide and then come back. And I'm just going to read to you a little bit from this slide, from this text that I was just quoting. Again, this text is The Functions and Disorders of the Reproductive Organs from 1857. So just a little bit more from this book. It states, there are many females who never feel any sexual excitement whatever. Others, again, immediately after each period, do become to a limited degree capable of experiencing it. But this capacity is often temporary and will cease entirely till the next menstrual period. The best mothers, wives, and managers of households know little or nothing of sexual indulgences. Love of home, children, and domestic duties are the only passions they feel. As a general rule, a modest woman seldom desires any sexual gratification for herself. She submits to her husband, but only to please him, and but for the desire of maternity, would far rather be relieved from his attentions. Isn't that interesting? So it just goes to show us that this was the information coming from the scientific or medical community at the time about women's sexual desire. And if we look at our modern culture today, what are some of the biggest problems that women have? It's not having desire and not having enjoyment from sex if they actually have it, and some women even having pain with sex. So these are the primary issues that come up with women, and we know that it's not normal, it's not healthy, because other women have sexual desire, enjoyment from sex, and have sex without pain. So I believe that what we're seeing in women today is still reflecting this cultural idea that a healthy woman should not have sexual desire. Okay, I'm going back one slide here. So we're going to talk a lot more about the Victorian era and the science at the time in the next slide as well. But I just wanted to give you an idea that science, as it was emerging in the 1800s and at the beginning of the 20th century, was a very limited field. The, quote, doctors of the time often went to medical school for, I think, around 2 months, and they maybe saw one cadaver, and they were sent out into the world with leeches to bleed people and ways to make people either vomit or have diarrhea. That was the way that most problems were treated until the pharmaceuticals came about. So this it's just interesting to see again what science and medicine were stating about human beings in regards to sexuality not that long ago. And we're going to talk more about that in the next slide. So, but taking a moment, so out of the Victorian era, we had Dr. Alfred Kinsey emerge, and he grew up in this world where sexuality and masturbation were forbidden. Sexuality could take place within marriage, but it should be limited. It should be for procreation. And he grew up in a very religious household, went on to become a biologist, and ended up studying sexuality. And in 1948, he published a book called The Sexual Behavior in the Human Male. And in 1953, he published another text called The Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. And his work disputed the notions that women are not sexual. So his work stood in the face of the, quote, science of the time, the literature of the time, that was disseminating this false information about sexuality, that, you know, healthy people had no sexual desire, that lots of crazy information that was around at the time, that masturbation could cause blindness, that oral sex could cause infertility. And Dr. Kinsey conducted these landmark studies of male and female sexual behavior, where he basically just interviewed people about their sexual histories. And again, it's said that he helped usher in the sexual revolution of the 1960s and 70s. So his first book about men was based on over 5,000 sexual histories, providing a series of revelations about the prevalence of masturbation, adulterous sexual activity, and homosexuality. And his second book on women, based on almost 6,000 sexual histories, contained many revelations about women's masturbatory practices, premarital sexuality, and orgasmic experiences. So these books were really profound because, first of all, they were telling the truth about human sexuality, and nobody wanted to talk about the truth with human sexuality. And it also got the conversation started about sex and led to other people starting to look at it and to really make it a science. Because prior to that, it was controlled mostly by religion, which we're also going to talk about in a future slide. So moving on to terminology. So one of the things I find really interesting is what is in a name. So our language around things is so powerful. And I really learned that studying a second and a third language, just how powerful language is and communicating how we as a culture view something on a deeper level. Because sometimes it's not even, we're not even conscious of it. There are just a couple of things to understand before we go on to the next slides. There's two words that are really powerful in what their Latin meaning is. The first is masturbation, which actually means to defile with the hand. And this, they believe it comes from a corruption of an unattested, of the word manustrupare, masturbation, to defile with the hand. For this reason, many people like to prefer to use the term self-pleasuring over masturbation because of this root word, manustrupare, to defile with the hand. Another word that's important to understand is pudenda, which is the word for vulva, and the pudendal nerve, which we're going to talk about in another class. It's a nerve that extends out of the sacrum and becomes the anal nerve, the perineal nerve, and the nerve that extends into the scrotum and the tip of the penis with men, and the rear of the vagina and the clitoris with women. And this nerve, the pudendal nerve, and the vulva, otherwise known as the pudenda, come from the Latin word pudere, and means that where one ought to feel shame. And I just think that it's really important to understand that these words that we use, these Latin words, show us how we feel about this part of the body, that to touch ourselves, to give ourselves pleasure, is to defile ourselves. In the Victorian era, they called it self-abuse or self-pollution, and that pudenda referring to the female parts and the pudendal nerve that refers to all these areas where we get pleasure, the anus, the perineum, the scrotum, the penis, the lower vulva, and the clitoris, that deep down the message is that where one ought to feel shame. So I find that very interesting, and we see how language changes with time, and but what's interesting is that science will often use the Latin, so I think we're going to be stuck with these terms for some time, so we'll see what happens with that. Okay, so we're moving on to the Victorian era, so and female hysteria. So we're going to get a better sense of what was going on for our grandparents and our great-grandparents in their experience of sexuality. So in 1894, Ruth Smithers published a book called Sex Tips for Husbands and Wives. And she wrote guidelines for about how newlywed women should, quote, endure sex. I think it's safe to say that this enduring of sex in marriage is still taking place today, unfortunately. So let's take a look at what this woman was stating in 1894. Again, this is not very long ago. This is just 120 years ago. The wise bride will permit a maximum of 2 brief sexual experiences weekly. And as time goes by, she should make every effort to reduce this frequency. Feigned illness, sleepiness, and headaches are among her best friends in this matter. A selfish and sensual husband can easily take advantage of his wife. One cardinal rule of marriage should never be forgotten. Give little, give seldom, and above all, give grudgingly. Otherwise, what could have been a proper marriage could become an orgy of sexual lust. A wise wife will make it her goal never to allow her husband to see her unclothed body and never allow him to display his unclothed body to her. Many women have found it useful to have thick cotton nightgowns for themselves and pajamas for their husbands. They need not be removed during the sex act. Thus, a minimum of flesh is exposed. When he finds her, she should lie as still as possible. Bodily motion could be interpreted as sexual excitement by the optimistic husband. Sex, when it cannot be prevented, should be practiced only in total darkness. If he attempts to kiss her on the lips, she should turn her head slightly so that the kiss falls harmlessly on her cheek instead. If he lifts her gown and attempts to kiss her any place else, she should quickly pull the gown back in place, spring from the bed, and announce that nature calls her to the toilet. Arguments, nagging, scolding, and bickering prove very effective if used late in the late evening, about an hour before the husband would normally commence his seduction. So this was from this text from 1894. I think it's all somewhat familiar to us. We probably heard that some of this advice that was given to women in marriage not that long ago, and we also can probably laugh at it because some of it is still present in our culture today. And in this marriage and in relationships, sexual relationships between men and women, you know, we have jokes about feigning headaches and whatnot. There's another important thing about this piece, and that is that publishing actual sex education during that time could lead to being fined and or imprisoned. So what we see is that there was a lot of advice literature that was popular at the time and these advice texts, but actual sexual education, if you were to publish that information, you could be fined and or imprisoned, and there were people who were. So it's really... you can see that people had no access to information except for, you know, people like Ruth Smithers who were writing these advice columns for men and women. So again, this Victorian era idea is important to understand. Women were considered the weaker and the more innocent sex. She was considered to have little to no sexual appetite. Men represented the fallen, sinful, and lustful creatures, wrongfully taking advantage of the fragility of women. Again, this is important to understand because as much as women were considered the weaker sex and men were considered the fallen, sinful, lustful creatures, I believe that we still have these archetypes around today. Women are often lacking a sexual appetite, considered to be less sexual. They would rather, you know, cuddle after sex than men, and men, you know, want porn, and they're fallen and sinful and lustful. And we've taken this to be science. We've taken this to be true in Western culture about men and women in general. But if you get exposed to other cultures, and I really recommend everyone taking this course to read the book Sex at Dawn, because this book really looks at other ways of viewing sexuality from other cultures, and it will shake up your paradigm of how you see sex. In that book, he talks about how there are cultures where women are perceived as the sexually insatiable ones, that women want sex all the time. The men are, you know, trying to escape these lustful women. So it just shows you that a lot of this idea that we have around men and women just comes from this cultural sort of fad of the last several hundred years. And there are some fads that we've had around for several thousands of years since the introduction of agriculture and the Western religions that we've had and how that's influenced the view that we have of men and women. So again, women were portrayed as either frigid or else insatiable. And the most valuable thing that a woman could have was her chastity and her innocence. And here's just another piece by this author, Ruth Smithers. She writes, encouragingly, "By their 10th anniversary, many wives have managed to complete their childbearing and have achieved the ultimate goal of terminating all sexual contact with their husband." I just find that so funny that was the goal. The woman was seen as just an angel, as this angel in the house, the refuge for the menfolk from the trouble of public life, this domestic goddess who somehow retained her chastity, even as wife and mother, which if you've read my book, you know that I talk about the Virgin Mary archetype and how in Catholicism they believe that the Virgin Mary stayed a virgin, even though she was married to Joseph and went on to have other children that were not Immaculate Conception. There's this idea that they maintain their virginity and maintain this purity. So, women, we are still working against that idea, trying to bring out the truth about our sexuality, trying to own the fact that we are sexual, that we have sexual desire, that we enjoy sex. So it's a bit of an uphill battle, I would say, against all of these years and all this literature and, quote, science saying that we need to endure sex because we are not sexual. So that is definitely an important piece to have, an important piece to understand as a healthcare practitioner. So let's talk about the anti-masturbation devices of the Victorian era. So while women were being told not to have sexual desire and often were experiencing treatments for that, which we're also going to talk about, really horrible treatments, the men were also enduring these anti-masturbation devices, and we're going to talk about why circumcision came about later in the course, but there was this huge movement in the Victorian era to stop people from masturbating, so I'm just going to take a look at that. So to look at these anti-masturbation devices, I'm just looking to see if I have my slide in here. Okay, I have it here. Slide number 8, so hold with me here. So here are these anti-masturbation devices. We see on the left these rings that were placed around the penis at night, and when the man had an erection, often in his sleep, he would awake to pain, to blood from these little edges poking into his penis. I don't know that it's known how many of these were actually used, but they definitely exist because we see them here coming from a science museum in the UK. And then on the right, of course, we have another anti-masturbation corset. Okay, we're going to talk more about this later, but because there's a lot to talk about in the Victorian era. But I just wanted to, I guess, take a moment to show you that there were anti-masturbation devices. So we were stopping both men and women from having a sexual experience. Okay, we're going to return to that. But I'm going to talk about female hysteria now. So female hysteria was a medical, basically required a medical treatment that included clitoral stimulation to orgasm by a doctor, either by hand or via the newly invented electrical vibrator, and was considered to warrant surgery sometimes, hysterectomy, removal of the clitoris, removal of the ovaries to correct this hysteria. So hysteria actually goes back really, really far. The word hysteria comes from the Greek word for uterus, and women who were diagnosed with hysteria had often the following symptoms. They complained to doctors of anxiety, of sleeplessness, irritability, nervousness, having erotic fantasies, feelings of heaviness in the lower abdomen, wetness between the legs, faintness, again, sexual desire, fluid retention, muscle spasm, shortness of breath, loss of appetite for food, and a tendency to cause trouble, quote unquote. And again, in extreme cases, the woman might be forced to enter an insane asylum or undergo a surgical hysterectomy, either have her uterus out, her ovaries, or her clitoris, if she was diagnosed as having really untreatable hysteria. So let's just back up a bit, because hysteria has been around, like I said, for a long time. The first description referred to dates back to 1900 BC to the Egyptians and identifies the cause of hysterical disorders in spontaneous uterus movement within the female body. We also see here indications of the therapeutic measures that were taken depending on the position of the uterus, which must be forced to return to its natural position. If the uterus had moved upwards, the uterus could be pushed back down by placing malodorous and substances near the woman's mouth and nostrils, while scented ones were placed near her vagina. On the contrary, if the uterus had lowered, the document recommends placing the malodorous substance near her vagina and the perfume ones near her mouth and nostrils. And a physician, Melampus, spoke of the woman's madness as derived from her uterus being positioned by venomous humors due to a lack of orgasms and, quote, uterine melancholy. So it's interesting that dating all the way back to the Egyptians in 1900 BC, we have record of women being really hysterical and emotional and upset and having something to do with their sexuality. And then we have this physician who actually goes on to say that it's due to a lack of orgasms, and so it makes the uterus unhappy. It makes it melancholic because it doesn't have enough sex. So thus arose the idea of a female madness relating to this lack of a normal sex life. Even Plato argued that the uterus is sad and unfortunate when it does not join with the male and does not give rise to a new birth. And Aristotle and Hippocrates were of the same opinion. So some of them are saying that it has to do with birth and creation, and others are just saying it has to do with orgasms and connecting with masculine energy that a woman apparently needs for her health. So this is interesting that we have this idea prior to the Victorian era, way prior, that's saying that women actually do need sex, and if they don't get it, then we can at least have these malodorous substances to help push the uterus back in its place. There is a myth that is recorded here, represented, it's a collective way of curing melancholy of the uterus, and it's represented by the Dionysian experience of the Maenads, who reached catharsis through wine and orgies. So again, here was another reference to a myth that said, that explained that the uterus could be made happy by wine and orgies. That is definitely not the treatment that they were using during the Victorian era, but it would have been nice to be around when that was the treatment. So then we have Hippocrates in 5th century BC, who was the first to use the term hysteria. He also believed the cause of the disease lied in the movement of the uterus. For this reason, he suggests that even widows and unmarried women should get married and live a satisfactory sexual life within the bounds of marriage. So I find that interesting. It's not the first time I've read that where it was suggested that, yeah, you know, if your husband dies, you need to remarry so you can have a healthy sexual life. I believe this was also talked about during Roman times. I think that's where I recognize it from. And the unmarried women, they need to get married too so they can have sex because it's really important for their health. Okay, so this is the history of hysteria. Of course, there's a lot of time between 5th century BC and Hippocrates and the Victorian era. In the 1800s and beginning of 1900s, but what's important to understand is that there's always been this observation between a woman's relationship to sexuality and her health. The female hysteria, or hysteria of both genders, was widely discussed in the medical literature during the Victorian era, and the female hysteria was especially discussed because this treatment came about that I discussed when we first looked at this slide, which was that these medical doctors at the time discovered that they could treat female hysteria, all these symptoms, anxiety, sleeplessness, trembling, emotional ups and downs, by stimulating the clitoris to orgasm. They were doing it by hand, but were frustrated at how long it took, and actually invented the electrical vibrator to help these women come to clitoral orgasm faster and without hurting their hands. So this was a very strange time where sexuality was super repressed in society, and yet women would go to the doctor to have these clitoral orgasms to relieve this this tension, this stress, this female hysteria, because they weren't supposed to be having any pleasure from sex with their husbands, and they definitely weren't allowed to masturbate. But it's very troubling that hysterectomies were being performed and clitorectomies, and that women's healthy ovaries were being taken out. That is was not a good thing. There was also some hypnosis being used at the time. But it's, again, important to understand that today this is no longer recognized by medical authorities as a medical disorder. But for hundreds of years in Western Europe and the U.S., female hysteria was considered a medical disorder, and it was treated with the things I just mentioned. So very interesting part of our sexual cultural history. And going on to the next slide, you see some pictures of these women who had this hysteria. I like the one when you go to the right, 1, 2, 3 over, and it looks to me like she's kissing someone in her imagination. She's got her tongue out and her arms wrapped around, and these women have sexual energy, and it needs to go somewhere. And below that, we see a picture of this water douche that I think was tried out for a while, which, of course, makes me laugh because of that Sex and the City episode where Samantha, of course, is masturbating with water. And this is a very common way of masturbating, along with cloth or finger stimulation or any number of ways that human beings come up to self-pleasure. But it's just funny when it was being administered by doctors and even by midwives during that time. Okay, so now we are moving on to religion and masturbation. So there's more to want to talk about how religion has suppressed sexuality And again, I want to talk more about this anti-masturbation movement of the Victorian era that we've been talking about for some time now. Okay, I'm just adding a few more minutes onto our presentation because I think we're going to go on a little bit longer here. Okay, so religion. Religion has been suppressing sexuality for a very long time. It has been suppressing homosexuality. It has been suppressing sex before marriage. It has been suppressing masturbation. And it has been limiting sex to simply procreation. Of course, we all know about other situations with religion, such as Catholic priests molesting altar boys. We hear about different sex scandals in the churches. We know about the higher rates of sexually transmitted infections and teenage pregnancy in religious parts of the country. And, of course, we know about the unwanted children and poverty due to limitations on birth control that are placed by the Catholic Church. So there's a lot of suppression of our sexuality from religion, and religion is a big part of our culture. Here in the United States, we live in a country that is based on in Christianity. That's in our foundation, and Christianity has, we'll talk about it at the end of the list of religions here, but has not been a supporter of us as sexual beings to express our sexuality and discover it and own it and enjoy it. That's not really been a message of the Christian church. So just going through the list here, you're probably familiar with a lot of this, and a lot of it is in regards to masturbation, which is why we're going to talk about masturbation next. But the Catholic Church teaches that masturbation constitutes a grave moral disorder, and the magisterium of the church has declared without hesitation that masturbation is intrinsically and seriously disordered act. If you've ever talked to people who were raised in the Catholic Church, I've talked to men who were just terrified to masturbate. They considered it, you know, that you were disordered, you were perverted, something was wrong with you, it was a grave moral disorder, and a lot of them have ideas that bad things can happen if you masturbate. So there's a lot of fear around it. And of course, this leads to men who masturbate very quickly and secretly, and then don't learn to control their sexuality and, you know, are therefore not going to become great partners. They're going to, sexual partners, they're going to learn to suppress their own pleasure and orgasm and just experience ejaculation rather than the orgasm that they're capable of. And for women, if they don't masturbate, they often don't understand their bodies. They don't know how to reach orgasm either through the clitoris or vaginally when having sex. And this often leads to a really poor experience of sex. So this limit on masturbation in the Catholic Church is a big deal. And, of course, they want you to wait till you're married to have sex as well. In Eastern Orthodox Church, fornication, adultery, so sex before marriage or sex with someone you're not married to when you're married, and masturbation are considered to be sins of the heart. In the Seventh-day Adventist Church, Ellen G. White, one of the founders in the mid-19th century, warned her followers of her visions of disfigured humans and the consequences of masturbation, not only destroying one's life, but preventing access to heaven. She made claims that masturbation was the cause of many sicknesses in adults, from cancer to lung disease. She even stated that masturbation claimed many sinners' lives prematurely. This is, again, very much a reflection of the ideas of the time of the Victorian era. But this church rose up during that time, so it carried a lot of those ideas. She believed that one's diet had a direct correlation to one's urge to masturbate. Again, this is very Victorian. She claimed that a healthy diet consisting of fruits, vegetables, wheat breads, and water could lead to a diminished urge to masturbate, and thus would lead to a healthier and more fulfilling life. To ultimately produce a guide for future generations, she claimed solitary vice, or masturbation, was the cause of hereditary insanity, cancer, and other deadly diseases, appealing to parents to protect their children by not engaging in this, quote, solitary vice or masturbation. So there was a lot of, during the Victorian era, people preaching and teaching these parents that they needed to protect their children from these diseases that they could have. You saw insanity, cancer, and other things that could be brought about by masturbating. The Jehovah's Witnesses teach that masturbation is a habit. There's a form of uncleanness, one that fosters attitudes that can be mentally corrupting. So again, we see here there's nothing saying masturbation is a normal, healthy, sexual, process. We're all touching and pleasuring our genitals. We even have proof that we started in the womb now. There was no one really sharing that idea, except maybe the Wiccans, who have a saying or something that they have in their text that says, "And it harm none, do as thou wilt." And there's a key piece of Wiccan literature in which the goddess says, "All acts of love and pleasure are my rituals." So at least there was one religious group that I've got here on the list that was supporting acts of love and pleasure. But again, the majority of Western culture is based in Christianity, where sex before marriage is a sin, sex with someone outside of who you're married to is a sin, masturbation is a sin, and sins cause you to go to hell. So sex or masturbation could therefore equal eternal punishment in the fires of hell. So if you're raised with this as being real, you can imagine that this would be very scary and would produce a lot of shame. And again, if you're working as a healthcare practitioner with clients and making this in 2015, you're going to find that a lot of your clients and patients were raised with religion, and they have these holdups around sexuality, around pleasure, around masturbation, around how much pleasure they should feel with a partner because of these religions. So, again, really important to understand the role that they've played in people's lives. Okay, so we're still talking about this anti-masturbation movement. And, again, it's such a big deal because when you shame someone's experience of their own genitals, that, to me, that's going right to the core of it. If you talk about sex in general, people might sort of listen for a while and eventually come up with their own idea. But when you shame them at such a young age and teach them that their own body is dirty, that their own impulse, their own pleasure, their own desire is wrong and actually harmful, you actually cut off their ability to not only have pleasure in their own bodies, but to experience pleasure through sex and through connection with other people. And when we view our bodies and our genitals very negatively, the body is going to respond to that. And, that's where in my work I see that when someone's having chronic vaginal, bacterial vaginosis, or yeast infections, or problems with the uterus, or with men, issues with their erection, with their prostate, with their testes, that there's often prior to that this negative relationship that was fostered with their genitals based on the religion that they grew up in or conversations with their parents or how they were made to feel as children about their genitals. And again, this often takes place when we're so young that we don't have a conscious memory of it. So it's just really deep in the unconscious, and anything that's unconscious is really running the show. So it's important to understand what was done during this anti-masturbation movement so that we can understand how people's relationship to their personal body and their personal sexuality was affected. Okay, so again, the Victorians considered masturbation to be a form of self-abuse or self-pollution. Masturbation during that time was known as onanism, because there's a story of Onan who spills his seed in the Bible. So I think in that story, he actually pulls out and spills the seed to not make a baby. But any spilling of the seed was considered bad during this time, whether through not making a baby or through masturbating. Masturbation was called the destroyer of civilization and was believed to weaken the body and society itself. Masturbation was believed to corrupt the soul and led to physical failure, a, quote, deranged mental capacity, and to falling into a hideous marasmus and a disgusting decrepitude. Many medical practitioners during this time believed that masturbation caused a wide range of mental and physical disorders that could even prove fatal over a time. Yes, the medical practitioners believed that masturbating could kill you. This was the science of the time. This was the cultural belief. So I have here a quote, that insanity arises from masturbation is now beyond a doubt, declared one widely read authority, who also claimed that masturbators became withdrawn, flabby, pale, self-mutilating, and consumptive. In 1758, the Swiss doctor Samuel Auguste Tissot claimed that masturbation was more dreadful than smallpox because it depleted the body of sperm, which provided vital energies, and that those who regularly masturbated could expect to form pustules on the face, the nose, the chest, the thighs, among other things. They really believed that masturbation was going to hurt the body and cause all of these mental and physical disorders. Again, during this time, doctors were masturbating women to orgasm to heal them, but at that time, they didn't consider, again, because they weren't touching themselves, this was allowed. But touching yourself was definitely not allowed. Okay, so now we're getting to the anti-masturbation devices, which I don't know how they wound up on that earlier slide, but you've seen them now. Some of the other anti-masturbation devices included a penis cooling device, invented by Frank Orth, is Stevenson spermatic truce, a sawtooth steel penis ring to prevent erection, which we saw in the picture, a leather and steel penis corset, which we also saw in the picture. That one was actually invented by a Dr. Fleck in 1931, so it was a very late invention. These and dozens of other types of cages and chastity contraptions were routinely used on boys and men, not only in clinics, but in hospitals and mental wards throughout Europe and North America. And again, unfortunately, there were psychiatrists that applied themselves to the task of curing male masturbation by causing intense pain to their genitals. This was also done to women. But I think it's really interesting, again, to see how much pain was inflicted on the male sex organ. We're going to talk about it a little bit more here, but I just think that, you know, for all of the suppression of female sexuality that I talk a lot about in my work and shows up a lot in, again, women's experience of sexuality in this modern world, it's really interesting to me how much male sexuality has been criminalized and how much pain they've had applied to their genitals, that the circumcision that has been done so routinely in Western culture is based in this idea that if we circumcise boys, they especially without anesthesia, then they will have this relationship to their penis of pain and they won't masturbate. So it's all a part of this anti-masturbation movement. Okay, so we're going to talk some more about anti-masturbation devices and procedures here. Okay, so yeah, let's look a little bit about what some of the authorities were saying and doing during this time. So the first woman medical doctor to graduate from an American medical school, Dr. Blackwell, wrote The Counsel to Parents on the Moral Education of Children, which she openly disproved of, calling it one of the, she openly disproved of masturbation, calling it one of the, quote, two vices from which all other forms of unnatural vice springs, unquote. She blamed it for domestic violence and for making both women and men lose their self-control. Now, to give her some credit, she did also claim it was wrong to think that women were any less sexual than their male counterparts. But again, like all the physicians of the time, she believed that that masturbation was really ruining not only the individual, but society. I also have a well-known London gynecologist and surgeon named Isaac Baker Brown, who felt that masturbation was the widespread cause of nervous disorders like epilepsy, and further theorized his view in his book on the curability of certain forms of insanity, epilepsy, catalepsy, and hysteria in females of 1866. He came up with what he thought the perfect solution to masturbation. He introduced in 1858 the clitorectomy. It became Baker Brown's signature quick fix to remedy the insatiable female, and for years he removed the clitoris on an unknown number of women. This is super upsetting to me to read, but this is what happened. In 1867, he was banned from the London Obstetrical Society and went insane, and while the clitorectomy was no longer practiced in Britain, it lived on in the United States well into the 20th century. In 1894, Dr. A.J. Block, a physician from New Orleans, shared his disgust over female masturbation in an article entitled Sexual Perversion in the Female. In it, he describes one of his own successes, a case in which a 19-year-old girl was cured of a nervous disorder. He said that while examining her, her body responded with short and rapid breaths when he touched her clitoris, a pale foot face, and slight moans, and he deduced that the clitoris itself was the cause of her disease and therefore aptly removed it. In 1868, English psychiatrist Henry Maudsley coined the term masturbatory insanity based on the assumed damage masturbation caused to the brain. There were several gynecologists that blamed the mind's madness directly on the ovaries, and Dr. Robert Batty of Rome, Georgia, was one such gynecologist, and his operation where he removed the healthy ovaries of a woman was referred to as Batty's operation, or an ovariotomy, where he began to remove both fully functioning healthy ovaries in order to treat menstrual madness, nymphomania, and masturbation. So these inhumane practices around masturbation and hysteria continued well into the early 1900s, even as medical opinion and attitude towards masturbation were beginning to change. In 1936, Holt's Diseases of Infancy and Childhood still recommended the cauterization of the clitoris as a way to cure female masturbation. So again, 1936, I know my grandmother was alive, and there were many people who were still being treated for, you know, for masturbating as children or as teens. So moving on to diet. So this is really interesting thing to understand about our culture. So one of the most famous anti-masturbation advocates of the 1890s was John Harvey Kellogg of Kellogg's Cereal. And in his campaign against masturbation, he drew upon these contemporary scientific rumors that masturbation-related deaths, where such a victim literally dies by his own hand, and many of his contemporaries joined him in this claim that masturbation caused cancer of the womb, urinary diseases, nocturnal emissions, impotence, epilepsy, insanity, as well as numerous other disabilities. So Kellogg, as a anti-masturbation advocate, was a part of this movement to rehabilitate masturbators through extreme measures, including genital mutilation of both sexes, so the circumcision of young boys without painkillers to curb masturbation, and the application of phenol to a young woman's clitoris. He also produced cages for boys' genitals. There was electric shock therapy that was used. One method was that they would insert silver sutures into the penis to prevent an erection. The foreskin is drawn over the glands, and the needle to which the wire is attached is passed through from one side to the other. After drawing the wire through, the ends are twisted together and cut off close. It's now impossible for an erection to occur, and the slight irritation thus produced acts as the most powerful means of overcoming the disposition to resort to the practice. And by that, they mean masturbation. So there were extremely horrible things done to the genitals of young men and women during this time. And to support this anti-masturbating lifestyle, people believed that the diet was really a big part of that. So Kellogg was also one of those people. He believed that a diet rich in fiber and poor in taste was essential to dampening these lusty urges. He was a part of creating oatmeal and cornmeal biscuits to feed the patients while working at a sanitarium. And later, him and his brother developed the, quote, perfect anti-masturbatory breakfast, which is Kellogg's cornflakes. So we now still have Kellogg's cornflakes. They have sugar in them. But imagine Kellogg's cornflakes with no sugar and how bland that would be after people were used to eating warm, sweetened breakfast cereals. It was believed at the time that if the food did not, if it was not sweet or spicy, that it would not bring about these lustful urges. It was also encouraged for people to avoid meat, as they thought that meat really got you going, I guess. And there was another food that you're going to recognize. Earlier in the century, Presbyterian minister Sylvester Graham created an unsweetened cracker. This is the graham cracker that we know today. This reverend railed against the evils of, quote, self-abuse from his pulpit each Sunday and thought that the blandness of what eventually, again, became known as the graham cracker would curb one's sexual appetite. So, again, these foods now exist with sugar, but back then they were created to feed people these awful bland foods so that they would not become too excitable. Very, very interesting. Okay, so we are finding my slide here. Okay, so lastly, we're going to talk about circumcision. So as late as the 1860s, circumcision was viewed primarily as a Jewish practice until doctors began to view it as a way of preventing men and boys from masturbating. One 1895 medical journal calls circumcision the physician's best friend and ally because it provides immunity from after reproach. It was seen as a way to cause so much pain to the penis that the men would not want to masturbate, but also because they cut off the extra skin and they couldn't move the skin, they wouldn't want to masturbate or wouldn't be able to masturbate. So I'm just going to, let me see if I have a slide here. Okay, yeah, I'm going to move forward. So these are the anti-masturbation devices we looked at earlier. And here is an ad for the Kellogg cereal on the left. And here is, on the right, a piece about circumcision that I'm going to read you now. So it states, there must be no play in the skin after the wound has thoroughly healed, but it must fit tightly over the penis. Or should there be any play, the patient will be found to readily resume his practice, not begrudgingly the time and extra energy required to produce the orgasm. It is true, however, that the longer it takes to have an orgasm, the less frequently it will be attempted. Consequently, the greater the benefit gained. Tubes, rings, clamps, and directors devised as aids in circumcision are worse than useless on account of the time involved in their manipulation and also because they necessitate the use of a knife instead of scissors, thus inducing more hemorrhage and most likely necessitating interrupted sutures instead of the continuous. We may not be sure that we have done away with the possibility of masturbation, but we may feel confident that we have limited it to within the danger lines, which is the primary object sought, as we are from the outset striving for the hygienic, not the moral benefit. The latter is usually too far from our reach to even consider. The younger the patient operated upon, the more pronounced the benefit, though occasionally we find patients who are circumcised before puberty that require a resection of the skin, as it has grown loose and pliant after that epoch. Mental depression following circumcision is practically unknown, and the only patients in whom there is any but the most pronounced physical gain are those above 50 years old. And we might note, too, that after that age, masturbation seems to have very little influence on the health, the patient seemingly having passed the period at which the drain can do much harm. Many of the boys and younger men begin to show marked gain in weight and even in mental activity within 10 days after the operation. Generally, the patients do not object to the operation when its nature and object are fully explained to them. Indeed, some of the most intelligent insist on being done acknowledging their inability to free themselves of their habit voluntarily. So this is very interesting to understand about the time why circumcision was being done. And now, of course, we have a movement against circumcision where many parents are saying there is no health benefit to this, and it's cutting off major nerve endings of the penis, and we are finally starting to stop this practice. But a lot of people are continuing it because the fathers feel they want their son's penis to look like them, or we have this idea as a culture that an uncircumcised penis is ugly, and just developed all these cultural ideas around it. But it's important to understand that it was developed to stop men from masturbating, to stop them from feeling pleasure, because of this false science that it was actually draining their life force, could cause diseases and or kill them. So important to understand. Okay, we're on to nearly our last slide here, and we're going to talk about slut shaming. Okay, I have just 9 minutes here. So I want to start by talking about sexual bullying. So this is sort of a new concept in our culture, especially with Facebook and phones and cameras on phones and the internet. And the three women that I want to introduce you to that are important as we talk about sexual bullying. Oops, I just clicked on my slide. I didn't mean to do that. There we go. Okay, so these three beautiful girls, I want to tell you about them. So the first one on the left, in November 2011, Ritae Parsons, then 15, allegedly went with a friend to a home in which she was reportedly raped by four teenage boys. The teenagers were drinking vodka at a small party. Parsons had little memory of the event, except that at one point she vomited while a boy was allegedly raping her. The incident was photographed, and the photo became widespread at Parsons' school and town in 3 days. Afterwards, many in the school called Parsons a slut, and she received text messages and Facebook messages from people requesting to have sex with her. The alleged rape went unreported for several days until Parsons broke down and told her family. Parsons, 17 years old, attempted suicide by hanging on April 4th, 2013, at her home in Nova Scotia, Canada, leading to a coma and the decision to switch her life support machine off on April 7th. Her death has been attributed to online distribution of photos from alleged gang rape. And on Facebook, there is a page set up as a tribute to her daughter, where Parsons' mother blames the four boys who allegedly raped and released images of her, the subsequent constant bullying and messaging and harassment, and the failure of the Canadian justice system for her daughter's decision to commit suicide. In response to Parsons' suicide, Nova Scotia enacted a law in August 2013 allowing victims to seek protection from cyberbullying and to sue the perpetrator. Another victim of sexual bullying or slut shaming is this second girl here, Amanda Michelle Todd. She committed suicide at the age of 15 at her home in British Columbia, Canada. Prior to her death, Todd had posted a video on YouTube in which she used a series of flashcards to tell her experience of being blackmailed into exposing her breasts via webcam, bullied, and physically assaulted. The video went viral after her death, resulting in international media attention. At the time of her death, in response to her death, Christy Clark, the premier of British Columbia, made an online statement of condolence and suggested a national discussion on criminalizing cyberbullying. Also, a motion was introduced in the Canadian House of Commons to propose a study on the scope of bullying in Canada. There's also Todd's mother receives donations to support anti-bullying awareness, education, and programs for young people with mental health problems. And the third girl here, Audrey Pott, was a 15-year-old student attending Saratoga High School in California, and she committed suicide by hanging September 12th of 2012. She had been sexually assaulted by three teenage boys at a party 8 days earlier, and pictures of the assault were posted online with accompanying bullying. In April 2013, so the following spring after her death, three 16-year-old boys were arrested in Northern California on suspicion of sexual battery. Pott's parents filed a lawsuit against the three teenagers, a civil case filed by Pott's parents. went forward to trial in April 2015. The case reached settlement prior to going to trial. As a part of the terms of trial, two of the boys were required to verbally apologize in open court, admit again to the sexual assault, admit to their role in the death of Audrey Potts, agree to being filmed in a documentary, pay a combined $950,000, support the petition for an honorary diploma for Audrey Potts, and give 10 presentations on sexual assault, sexting, and slut shaming. So this is a big part of this current culture where we live in, where young people are dealing with sexual bullying and cyberbullying, and women across the board are dealing with slut shaming. Some men, of course, are probably dealing with this as well, but it's especially an issue that women have to deal with. From this phenomena, we have the emergence of the UnSlut Project, which promotes gender equality, sex positivity, and comprehensive age-appropriate sex education for all ages. It's a collaborative space for sharing stories and creating awareness about sexual bullying, slut-shaming, and related issues. Started in April of 2013 and has expanded to include the stories of girls, women, and men. These shared stories provide hope to girls who are suffering and demonstrate to us all just how widespread the issues of sexual bullying and slut-shaming really are. And their goal is to create a world where the word slut doesn't even make sense as an insult. So this is a part of the sex positive movement that's taking place, trying to change this word slut and how it's being used and how as a culture we relate to female sexuality. You know, we see these young teenage girls who are just gorgeous, healthy, sexual beings, as they should be, and yet they are slammed for or shamed for being sexual beings. And this is a big problem in our culture, and I think that these girls are reflecting what's happening on a bigger level and what I think all women are experiencing on some level, which leads me to healthcare. I believe that women are slut-shamed in healthcare in a huge way. I experienced this when I was visiting a gynecologist and hearing what they had to say about bacterial vaginosis, HPV, yeast infections. Essentially, your healthcare practitioner, when they ask you, when you have bacterial vaginosis, for example, or HPV, how many sexual partners have you had? This is a very shaming question because it implies that you are doing something wrong if you've had too many sexual partners. Now, what is too many? I'm not sure. And it also, it's also just completely irrelevant because you can have a bacterial vaginosis infection and be a virgin, or a bacterial vaginosis imbalance, I should say. And you can have HPV from having just one sexual partner. So there's another thing I want to look at here, and it's this idea of high-risk sexual behavior. So having multiple partners is considered to be high-risk sexual behavior. So if you are someone who's sexual and you're not in a committed relationship with one person, you might have more than one sexual partner, which in this case means that you are participating in high-risk sexual behavior. So let's take a look at that. So high-risk sexual behavior puts people at risk for sexually transmitted infections, unplanned pregnancy, and being in a sexual relationship before being mature enough to know what makes a healthy relationship. Now, this is from a WebMD website. Teens and young adults are at higher risk than adults. So I'm just going to read you this list, and I want you to just be open to sort of see it with new eyes. So examples of high-risk sexual behavior include unprotected intercourse without male or female condom use, except in a long-term single-partner monogamous relationship, unprotected mouth-to-genital contact, except in a long-term monogamous relationship, early sexual activity, especially before age 18, having multiple sex partners, having a high-risk partner, one who has multiple sex partners or other risk factors, having anal sex or a partner who does, except in a long-term single-partner monogamous relationship, and having sex with a partner who injects or has ever injected drugs, and exchange of sex work for drugs or money. So, again, you might just take this list and say, well, yeah, those are high-risk activities, but I want you to just